community radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's edition of Interchange on this very snowy night in Bloomington, Indiana. I'm Helen Harrell, and with me tonight is someone who's a very favorite person of mine. I've known him for many years, local attorney Guy Loffman. Welcome to Interchange, Guy.
Well, thank you, Helen. Glad to be here.
I really appreciate the fact that you come out in the snow, and I don't think you like it any better than I do.
Not the snow.
Well, let's tell a little bit about, I know you've been here in Bloomington a long time, and I always am curious how people end up in Bloomington. Were you a student here at IU? Or?
Came in 1963 as a freshman at IU.
Wow, 1963. Mm-hmm. Okay. I remember those years. I hope some of our listeners do as well. And where are you from?
Well, I was born in Ohio. My parents lived in Chagrin Falls, Ohio. I was born in Cleveland Hospital. And then I moved to Newark, Delaware, when I was about 6 years old, and then went to school and graduated from high school there, and graduated in 1963 from Newark High School, and then came to IU. And I've been basically in the Bloomington community ever since.
That's interesting how you picked IU from Delaware. I mean, what was it about IU that...
Well, the U.S. News and World Report used to do its evaluation of colleges, mm-hmm. and they said that Indiana University was the best educational buy in the United States. And my parents read that, and my mother was the University of Delaware is in Newark, and mm-hmm. my mom was at a cocktail party with the president of the University of Delaware, and he was singing the praises of IU. And his son came to IU, and she looked into it, and there were several reasons to think it was good. And then my brother came, and he had a great time here, and I came out and visited several times when he was in school. And you know, I figured there were several other schools I was looking at that were sort of small eastern schools, Haverford and some places like that. And I figured that might be exactly what I wanted. But no matter what I wanted, if I looked around, I could find it mm-hmm. at IU.
That's true. Did you know when you came here that you were going to go to law school?
Oh, no, never. Wouldn't have ever considered it.
And you started out majoring in what?
Economics, and eventually went to most of 1 year of graduate school in economics here at IU.
So did you also go to law school here?
Yes.
You did. Mm-hmm. So you've just been in Bloomington the whole time. I guess that's why I always thought that you actually were from Bloomington, because when I came here that you had been here a long time. That's sort of my perception. So
another reason a lot of people think I'm from Bloomington is when I was done with law school and settled down and started my family in 1975. My parents retired to Bloomington, and we built an addition to the house that my wife Connie and I have bought mm-hmm. and had bought. And my parents then lived with us for the next, lived in Bloomington until they died, and lived in the same house with us for 15, 16 years and helped raise our children through all those years. Excuse me, I'm going to apologize one time for my cough.
Oh, well, it's cold. It's snowy and cold. So
and so my parents were very active in the community, and many people knew them. So if I live here and my parents live here, people figure I must have been from here.
That does make sense. It does sort of send the message that you're all ensconced here for a long time. That's true. Is your brother still here? Or was he?
No. My brother was in the Atlanta area.
So what made you switch from, I mean, I don't know what you plan to do with an economic degree, but what made you go to law school?
Well, when I left the university, I was student body president, elected student body president in 1967 in the spring, and that was coming out of a history of being one of the radical leaders of the university. I helped organize the first anti-war demonstration in the spring in March of 1965. And in Dunmeadow, there were about a dozen of us who put that together. And then I helped organize the SDS chapter and was SDS president back before the Weathermen took over, back when it was a very idealistic and excellent institution, the Students for a Democratic Society. And out of that, we formed a student political party, the Progressive Reform Party, that ran candidates looking for to get elected to the Student Senate. And then out of that, I got elected student body president. Well, by that time, I was a senior when I was elected and served while I was a graduate student. While I was in graduate school, they abolished the graduate student deferment.
Remember that.
And when they abolished that, I was on the block for immediately being drafted and sent to Vietnam, or not, but certainly I was
on the list.
On the list.
Yes.
Coming right up for likely Vietnam service, certainly military service. And I was pretty cynical about grad school at that point. Anyway, I remember a professor. I wrote a paper on the negative income tax, which was a hot issue, and the professor wrote on it, "Aren't you a little young to solo?" You know, and I'm in graduate school. I thought I was finally, oh, no, you're a long way from getting to write things that you think are important, you know. And but if I'd applied for a temporary deferment, it would have hurt my ability to seek conscientious objector status. Mm-hmm. And that was a decision that I had made, that I would seek conscientious objector status. So I quit school because I didn't want to get drafted. I didn't want to seek a deferment, the short-term deferment. So I then applied for conscientious objector status, and with remarkable ease was granted it. Then I spent 2 years working as a physical therapy orderly in Bloomington Hospital, which were some of the most transformative years of my life, really. I'd been incredibly alienated by the time I was out of quit grad school. And we had, and I shouldn't leave out, I was married in 1967 to Connie Kiesling. And
you're still together.
And we're together 40, help me out here, 40 some years later.
Let's see, 44.
she and I had gotten our passports, and we were going to move to Zambia. Canada was just too cold for me.
Yes, I can relate to that.
and Zambia did not extradite draft resistors, so we were ready to abandon the United States. But then I got my CO status, mm-hmm. and then I worked at the hospital, and suddenly I was in many ways integrated into the heart of the community that I'd been so alienated from. And over those 2 years, I really changed. I think I changed my attitude toward the community. And it was also during that time that Connie and I helped form the Needmore hippie commune.
Yes.
And
it's still there,
which
in
is
some
still
form
there.
Or another.
And we lived there for several years, but that got terribly, terribly. Well, the biggest problem was violent. Following the one of the big demonstrations in Washington. A bunch of
wasn't that the May Day thing when
yeah.
people went down the river in Washington and. in canoes or something?
And well, I don't know that part, but there were mass arrests, and people were just sent checks for $5,000 if they'd been arrested. You know, it was such a terrible.
Yes, I was in Washington, D.C. at that time. Yes.
Well, I stayed back in Needmore tending my goats at the time of that, when I'd been to several others. These Vietnam vets moved into the house just down the street, plus some people who had been told to come out to idyllic Midwest, who were mixed race couples from Washington, D.C., not knowing that Brown County at that time, I trust it's not true anymore, but was
perhaps
incredibly racist, and the Klan was driving by with guns, and there were arsons.
Now, what year are we talking about here?
69.
Yeah, so
70.
You were there. I didn't come there until like 72, I think. Yeah. And I heard all those tales.
Yeah,
about
well,
what
I
happened out
I
there.
And then they one night they burned a cross across the street from this house, and I know this one interracial couple came and knocked on our door, and we took them in, and it was, and then the community took up arms. They were going to fight back, and I was a conscientious objector. I am a conscientious objector, and I did not want to be associated with a community that was going to have a violent response to that.
Well, weren't there several Vietnam vets living there at the time or something? I
right.
heard about,
there
and they were the
there
ready
was a combination of Vietnam vets against the war, and they would sit there on the porch and draw a bead on every car that went by. They flew a Viet Cong and an American flag outside, mm-hmm. and they were both upside down, saying both these countries are in distress, but this was a little subtle,
yes.
for the average Klansman
in Brown
and Morgan County to say that this was a subtle statement. So we packed up and left, and then instead of being a subsistence farmer for the rest of my life, which is where my planning had gotten to, I had to really rethink things, and within a month, a family member, one of my family members, said to me, "Guy, you ought to go to law school." And I said, "Jack, maybe you're right. I'll think about that." So you asked me how I got to law school?
That's how you got
That's
there.
That's how I got to law school.
It's really interesting when our lives really paralleled as far as politics. I was a member of SDS. I was in Washington, D.C. and at that time. And I remember all these things. But when I came here, and it's roundabout how I ended up at Needmore after I came here, but I'd heard about you. People talked about you. And I ended up the way we met, in case listeners are interested, is that I ended up I moved into a house, and by moving into that house, the people moved out, but I inherited their goats, and I inherited a dog that they had. Its name was Fawnlicker.
I'd forgotten
and
you
that
were
was your dog.
Fawnlicker,
yes.
Absolutely.
And I had her for several years, and that's why people said, "Oh, well, you have to meet Guy and Connie because they have the same politics you do." Exactly, they have the same experiences. But it did take a while for me to kind of hunt you down and find you because I had a small son at the time. But I'm thinking about those. I heard all those stories. I've never actually heard anybody that was there that was, should we say, sober that could tell me the details of what happened at the time. I know there was a lot going on, and the Klan certainly scared me. They actually did go by my house a few times, too, when I lived out there.
Yeah.
That was my first experience, and it was kind of frightening.
Big, burly men in open Jeeps and pickup trucks not waving back.
That's right. They don't. And the dogs are growling, yes.
I'd always wave at them, but they never wave back.
Well, you know, one thing I was thinking while you were sitting here talking about this is being a conscientious objector, and you know, the tone of the country now about war and a military and our soldiers and everything is so different from what it seemed to be back then. I mean, to a lot of us, there are probably a lot of people sitting here thinking, how can you be a conscientious objector? Well, we heard that you hated the soldiers when they came back and all that kind of thing. And how could you be that way? And I don't think being a conscientious objector is necessarily the same thing as, you know, hating the soldier. But what people don't keep in mind is people were drafted back then. You had no choice. We have an all-volunteer army now, or military now. They don't draft people anymore. So it is their choice to go. And I think, do you think the government's done a better job of promoting the wars we have now, making it look better, like it's the right thing to do? Vietnam was a disaster. It was the first one on TV that people could actually sit at their dinner table and see this horrible carnage going on over in Vietnam and what was happening to the soldiers. Do you think that how do you think the media's played into that, and how do you think the public attitude now? They still view us as being really wrong and really radical and crazy.
Well, number one, I think you're absolutely right. They've learned to sell it better. They've learned to control the media, the embedded journalist, you know, the embedded journalist, you know, who is part of that. And everybody who studied military reality knows that the people who you're next to are the people you're loyal to. You're fighting for your buddies. You're not fighting for the country by the time bullets start flying. And there were very, very hateful people against those in the military, but I have never been that. I have complete respect for different people's views and different people's religions. My conscientious objection is a religious belief of mine. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you to me, it doesn't mean you're a sinner or you're an evil person if your religion allows you to serve in the military. Mm-hmm. My religion doesn't allow me to serve in the military. The day I was drafted, the same draft board in Wilmington, Delaware, where I was registered to be in the Selective Service System, in the same meeting, drafted my brother for certain Vietnam duty, because he was a doctor. Mm-hmm. So I've always felt like they took one son and they left the other home. And Bert and I, my brother, it was, I don't mean it wasn't tough, but we always maintained our respect for each other and our affection for each other, even though he was serving in Vietnam and while I was doing my conscientious objector service.
Well, we need to take a break right now. And so you are listening to Guy Laufman. I'm Helen Harrell. This is tonight's Interchange, and we'll be right back.
Support for WFHB comes from The Hidden Closet in Fountain Square Mall, featuring vintage and unique gifts for Valentine's Day and springtime clothing arriving in late February. The Hidden Closet, 345-7717. And from Stafford Law Office, LLC, handling all types of family law, now offering collaborative law, a divorce process based on mutual respect where both parties agree in advance to resolve their issues through a mutually agreeable settlement without going to court. GLBTQI clients are welcome. For an initial consultation, Stafford Law Office is available at 339-6055 or on the web at cstaffordlaw.com.
And welcome back to Interchange. Thanks for staying with us tonight. I'm Helen Harrell, and I am talking with Guy Laufman, who's a local attorney here and a social activist of sorts. When we left you a moment ago, we were talking about some of the attitudes about Vietnam and the politics, but you went to law school, and in law school you can certainly branch out and go in lots of different directions. So how did you incorporate your politics with the study of law in your practice?
Well, one of the wonderful things about law is you have tremendous number of choices as to what you can do with it. And when I got out of law school, I had decided that I wanted to live in Bloomington, that I liked Bloomington. It was a great place. I've had good luck in Bloomington and wanted to stay here. So I found an opportunity to start practicing law here, practiced in a small firm for 10 years, and then over 25 years ago, I went into solo practice. And at that time, Connie, my wife, our younger child, Eric, was going to first grade, so she was sort of coming back on the labor market, and I said, well, listen, let's just try opening a law office together. And we've practiced at ever since then at and the Morgan House, the nice old Bloomington Restoration's first restored property, was just available for occupancy, and we moved in there and subsequently bought the building. And we've been practicing with me as the lawyer and Connie as the office manager for over 25 years now. And the wonderful thing about that is I have great freedom as to what I'm going to do when I come in the morning, and whether I'm going to what I'm going to volunteer for, and what I'm not. So I've always spent a lot of time doing things that I thought were interesting and valuable, some of which included the law. For instance, back in the when there was in the first Iraq War, there was a die-in, and yes. I volunteered to work with the prosecutor and organize the flow of that, so that people could get processed through, and everybody could make the political statement they wanted with them. It didn't unnecessarily disrupt the justice system, and that was the kind of thing that I found I really enjoyed doing. About 15 years ago, I really, when my kids were out of high school and I wasn't going to soccer games and Sounds of South and hockey games and coaching hockey and all those things I'd been doing as my kids grew up, I recognized an opportunity to get re-engaged in some new activities. And at that point, I realized that all of my life, one of the most pivotal moments was Brown versus Board of Education and school education, school integration. I grew up in Delaware, and Delaware was a slave state that did not secede from the Union. And the Emancipation Proclamation didn't apply to Delaware. Delaware could keep its slaves even after the Emancipation Proclamation because they weren't in rebellion. And I went to segregated schools when I was a boy. The black kids weren't allowed to go to the white kids' schools in Newark, Delaware. And I remember the school being integrated, and I remember very well that Saturday Evening Post cover of the little black girl walking to school in the white dress and the tomatoes and the National Guardsmen, and watched it on TV too. And those people were just heroes to me. They were my early heroes.
Incredibly brave, amazingly brave.
Incredibly brave people. And when I saw this opportunity, I realized we had made immense progress since the 1950s. But boy, did we hadn't gotten all the way there, and that I wanted to work with racial justice, that this was something I wanted to do, and that the place I wanted to do it was Bloomington, you know. And so Connie and I began participating in the NAACP, and I've been on their executive committee now for a dozen years probably. And it was in that context that there was a joint project that was carried out by the Monroe County Prosecutor's Office, which was Carl Salzman, and the Unitarian Universalist Church, which is my church, and the NAACP. And we did a racial justice study showing, looking at how the race interacts with the criminal justice system. And that was a very interesting thing to work in. And in fact, we were recognized by the American Bar Association for outstanding community coordination to address racial justice issues, because it was such a broad community-based group that addressed this. And we determined that we saw we did not see any evidence of racial profiling, which was very heartening. But we did find that, like every place else, blacks spend 2 to 3 times as much time in jail or prison for situations that appear to be similar to situations of white people right here in Monroe County. And that is one of the most intractable, difficult things that there is to address. And it is, in the conclusion we reached, it is present right here. And we are not immune from the negative impact of racial inequality in Monroe County, and we are not the oasis some people like to think we are.
I would have to agree with that. Has there been any impact from that study? Have there been any changes, anything that you know of? Have there been any, any steps taken, measures taken to try to correct some of these injustices or inequities?
Well,
and it is hard to address. I know it's something people don't see.
It is. We came up with short-term and long-term suggestions and recommendations. And I would have to say it's not very encouraging in terms of how those have been implemented. For instance, we wanted all police cars to have video cameras and video every arrest. It's the only way you can check that database and then have that information available to the public so you can do a study.
Well, I would think it would also protect the officers as well.
Absolutely. My understanding is that Carmel did this 15 years ago over great objection from the officers, who now wouldn't live without it, because it gives them protection, you know. And it probably helps make sure that they don't act in an inappropriate fashion, because you're on TV. You know, everybody's a little more careful when you're on TV, and that's good. The committee just, the people who had brought it together, where it ended. Carl Salzman was defeated, and Chris Gall is wonderful on these issues, and I have great confidence and faith in him, and think he's a excellent prosecutor. But he couldn't just step in where Carl had been very, very active in this and take it on. And Clarence Gilliam, who was one of the founders of the Monroe County branch of the NAACP and a pillar of the black community for 30 years, he was president of the NAACP, retired and moved to Indianapolis. And he was one of the great moving forces, and it just sort of we weren't when it got to the implementation stage. There wasn't the Marsha Bradford, who was who had been the Safe and Civil City coordinator, left the city, and those were the four primary people. And I was sort of the only one
left. Right.
And I couldn't carry that, you know, couldn't carry it on. So I feel like the study has definitely raised people's awareness that we're not an oasis, and I think people need to know that. But in terms of implementing the specific suggestions, I don't think it's happened.
What were the reasons, any reasons given for why they couldn't, for instance, purchase the cameras? I know it's probably expensive, but...
Well, yeah, that's right. It's expensive. Somebody has to get behind it. Somebody has to say this is where those dollars should go as opposed to someplace else. And I'm not in that loop. You know, I don't really know who decided they wouldn't. Or that I'm not part of that decision making process, but it didn't happen.
What are some of the other suggestions that the committee came up with?
Well, and some of them you can come up with, but they're very difficult to practically implement. One of the most important, and you'd think simplest, is in every criminal sentencing, record the race of the defendant. So that if you want to do this study, we had to go back to jail records and try to go take people's race from jailing from booking through the criminal process, because there was no way in the criminal process to determine their race. And we had to check with the U.S. Department of Justice, and they had to evaluate it. And their conclusion was, yes, you have the right to do this. And in fact, it's a good idea. And they recommended it. But it's one thing to say we're going to do this, to another thing to making sure that there is a practical way for the judge to record this. And in fact, we got very, very close to I worked closely with Judge Bridges and Judge Todd particularly. We had a system that we were all ready to plug in. But that was when Carl Salzman was defeated. Then, and we'd paid over $1,000 for the research on this system, but it disappeared. Nobody could ever find it. Nobody could ever find the software. And it's really too bad, because it was going to be an excellent, excellent pilot test of a way to keep track of these things. You know, it's one thing to have a great idea, and it's another thing to put it into effect. And putting it into effect is a lot harder than having a great idea.
Well, how does that affect you? I mean, you spent a lot of obviously several people spent a lot of time, energy, and some money on all this study and research and all that. And then, how does it make you feel to have it not be implemented, to just disappear? What does that say about the community, or does it say that we're in different times and people? I could see that people might think about recording the race as some kind of the issue could come up about profiling, for instance, and how would you implement recording race without profiling people or targeting them?
Well,
I could see
the theory is by the time the guy gets in court, the judge is not going to need to look at the docket sheet to figure out what this person's race is. But if I'm trying to do a study on sentencing, I need it in the docket sheet. So it's not going to contribute to profiling, or because the if you think that the judge might have bias, it's not going to be a source of the bias. That bias is going to come from the judge's observations.
But you may have just mentioned why it's not implemented, because obviously, the judge is going to see the person, yes, but research can't be done if you can't get that information.
Right, but the court was sympathetic to gathering this info. The judges, we had numerous meetings with Judge Kellams and Judge Todd and Judge Bridges. And the other thing is, Judge Bridges retired right then. He was another person who had been working hard on this and was working it, and he retired.
So do you think there's, among the new people, there's not a lot of interest in these issues?
No, I don't think that's the point. What I think the point is, to get anything changed takes a big group effort. And it's a small miracle when you get a big group that is as diverse as this together. And we worked as long as we could, and we got done as much as we could. When that group disperses to Indianapolis and to retirement and to
Florida.
And to private practice because you've been defeated, and and to Indianapolis because you need to live with your kids, you can't just snap your fingers and have a substitute group. And to me, we achieved a lot, and we couldn't implement it as far as I wish we could, but we did a lot. Mm-hmm. And I've been a social activist since 1965, and usually we don't get what we want. Usually we're defeated by the forces of money and power and racism and inertia, mostly inertia.
People who perhaps have an interest in maintaining the status quo rather than implementing change. You think that's part of it?
Of course, but I think a more powerful force is inertia. Mm-hmm. And people are used to what they're used to, and they do not trust change, and they do not like criticism of the way things are because they think things are pretty okay. And our judges were remarkably open to addressing these concerns. Mm-hmm. I was very impressed that they were so willing to look these issues in the eye. But we just didn't have the team to move it farther, and I couldn't put another team together at that point. It was a dream team.
Sure. Sounds like it.
And you can't just go put one of those together.
Do you think there's a personal price to pay for being an activist, especially in a smaller community, which Bloomington is a smaller community if you think about it?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, I've had a wonderful, wonderful experience in Bloomington. And it's remarkable how little personal hostility I've met for over the years for all the unpopular, off-the-wall, positions I've taken Vietnam days. You know, there were people who had, back when I was student body president, there was the Lynch Loftman movement, and people had these little Lynch Loftman buttons. But I didn't take it too seriously, and I always remember the call I got at 2 a.m. when I'd just been elected student body president, and this voice, hostile voice, says, "Is this Guy Loftman?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "You lefty liberal," and hung up on me, and I'd been told.
Yeah, that was frightening. Yes, that certainly was. That put you in your place.
Put me in my place.
Well, we have to take another station break, but we will be right back, and I hope listeners will stay with us.
Support for WFHB comes from Gene Arnholt, attorney at law, dedicated to winning Social Security disability and SSI benefits for disabled people. More information at 812-323-3332 or online at www.arnholtlaw.com.
And welcome back to Interchange. I'm Helen Harrell, and I'm talking with a local attorney and certainly social activist mover shaker over the years, Guy Loffman. We were talking about kind of the state of Bloomington and some of the things that you have tried to do in the community, some successfully, some not, and trying to make change and make things a little more equal for people. How do you see Bloomington now as compared to, say, we've covered, what, about 50 years here rapidly? Have there been changes in Bloomington? Is it a better place? It's always been kind of a comfortable place to live. It's not that it's a bad place to live. I mean, there's a lot of good things. But how is it different than it was, say, 50 years ago?
Well, let's see. It's pretty darn close to 50 years, isn't
it?
It
is, isn't it?
63. So that's close enough to say over the last 50 or so years. Well, one of the things about Bloomington is how it has retained its essential character, I think. It's always been just such a good place to be. People are generally nice to each other. If you know, they're nice at stop signs, at four-way stop signs, and you know, I live out in the country, and I wave at people when they drive by, and they wave at me. You know, I think we have basically over the years we have good government, and I think in many ways the community has built on its strengths. I think the university has held up very well over the years, and that's certainly the central element of our community. And back in the 70s, when they were ready to tear down everything, one of my first job I ever had as a law clerk in the summer of 73 was getting a federal injunction to keep them from tearing down the old Monroe County Library, which is now the History Center, and the old Carnegie Library, which is just a key element of the community. I think I got $63.12 for the entire summer's work, and it was well worth it, you know. And then the courthouse was under great attack to tear down the courthouse or put wings on it or
build a new one.
All sorts of issues, and that's when and they had $6 million estimates to refurbish it, and they couldn't do that. And as I recall, Bill Cook came in and he said, "I'll do it for $2.5 million, way under anybody else." And then they said, "Oh," well, and then they let it out to bids, and then somebody underbid Bill Cook, you know, and somebody else fixed it up, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful part of the community. And then, of course, the Cooks were so – Bill and Gail Cook were so active in the south side of the square and Fountain Square Mall, which is just such an anchor to the community, having recognized its history. And Bloomington Restorations has been a wonderful part of the community, so that I think the integrity of the community has increased as we've recognized the value of our own history and preserve these buildings. And of course, our office is in an 1881 old Victorian house that we're very pleased that we get to walk into and do business every day. And the house next door to it, the Bynum Fanyo's surveying office, is right there in that brick house. And then Eric Cook has the his law office is in the stone building, the old stone building, and it's just wonderful having those. But it's all over town. You've got this.
I definitely think Bloomington has a unique kind of a quaintness about it, and it has, as you're saying, all these restorations. They've modernized with still maintaining a certain quaint feeling of all the buildings, and of course, certainly the things that Bill Cook does. He does, they're amazing, but. Do you think Bloomington is doing a better job of resolving social issues, political issues. I think, you know, it tends to be a liberal town, whatever liberal means now, and yet, you know, there's plenty of the community and the county that's not so liberal. Do you think we're resolving issues better than we did a long time ago, or?
Well, one of the themes to me is that a great deal is done not on a community-wide basis, but on a bottom-up basis for things that work. Mm-hmm. And I'd put WFHB radio in it. Mm-hmm. Jeff Morris came to me back at the very start of the station, and I helped do some very early work on the legal work on the radio station when Jeff was, who's some people may not know, one of the original founders of WFHB radio. And another wonderful institution is certainly Blooming Foods, mm-hmm. you know, and the farmers market. These are things that give wonderful character and influence the community. As to government, itself, I think we've had a remarkably good history. We've had, for one thing, remarkably little scandal. You know, nobody's ever run off with the money, you know, remarkably.
That's a good point.
which is not true. I've worked elections. I've been on the election board, and I've worked countless elections. And while there can be rubbing up against each other and bumping into each other, it's always trying to get it done the right way and different people having a different view of how you should run this polling place. But I think I don't think anybody ever thinks anybody stole an election by you know, stuffing the ballot box in Monroe County. It's always been there's a lot of integrity in Monroe County, mm-hmm. and Republicans and Democrats have, you know, we've disagreed plenty, but I've seen remarkably little mud thrown for how big this community is and how diverse it is, and I think the government's done pretty well. I think our roads have held up, and I think our industry has held up. GE coming back. I mean, when I moved to my house on Victor Pike, it was I would drive by RCA every day and have the rush hour traffic. It was the world's largest color TV manufacturer. We've lost an awful lot of that base, but thanks to the Cooks and many other entities, and now GE coming back is great. We've held on to our business.
As you and I kind of head into our twilight years here, we aren't quite there yet. We keep delaying those. I think our, as they like to say, our generation is one who refuses to get old. So, what are you going to do? What do you want to do in the next few years? I doubt if the activist spirit is gone. I think I can still see that fire. Are there any particular things that you want to be involved with, or you think you're going to be involved with, or besides playing with grandchildren, which is always fun?
Yeah. I certainly a key element of my life for you know the last 30 or 35 years is the Unitarian Universalist Church, and I've sung in that choir for 30 some years, and it's, to me, it's just a wonderful organization. It's a wonderful church community for me, and has grown so over the years, better and better. And it's Marianne Macklin and Bill Breeden are wonderful ministers, and it's a real privilege to be part of that community. And I expect I will do that. I'll do that as long as I can. I'm quite active in the Democratic Party, and I'm probably the primary lawyer that you know advises the Monroe County Democratic Party, and I expect I'll stay active in the Democratic Party. I'm very pleased with my participation in the NAACP, and things come up all the time that people ask me to do, and some of the time I can say yes, I'll help with that. It's a little unusual that my daughter Eve Cusack and her husband Sam Cusack were in New Orleans when Katrina hit, yeah. And they evacuated to our house, and it's 5 years later, and we've just made it permanent, which is wonderful for us, because we have our almost 5 year old granddaughter Della with us every day, and her little sister 1 year old Nola every day, so it's just a wonderful living situation for us to have family with us, and of course my parents helped raise our children in that same house, and now we're helping raise our grandchildren in the same house. And I'll probably be back to watching soccer games and getting to gymnastics and maybe Sounds of South again someday, because I it's such fun to be so closely involved with the grandchildren's life. But I just nobody's had better luck than me. Nobody's had a better way to enjoy things, and I'm very pleased with the way it's going, and I'm going to keep doing it as long as I can, pretty much the way it is. And social activism is a fundamental part of my being and my sense of satisfaction.
Well, before we end our conversation in a couple of minutes here, is there anything... I mean, the tone of the country right now, that's obviously lots of hostilities, and a lot of it doesn't necessarily touch us here in Bloomington. That's true. I mean, it seems like we are a little bit, but you can't watch the news without seeing it. And what do you think, what can we do? What can everybody do to kind of make things better, to how to think about things? Think about this. I guess I don't hate to put names on people. This radical evangelical kind of led group that, you know, don't represent to me what, you know, the other Christians in the world that are doing good. What can we do here in Monroe County, in Bloomington? What can you do? What do you think about doing to make things better?
Well, I think Bloomington, I think the extent of tension in the United States and in Bloomington as a little part of it is the greater the tension, the less civility, the more intolerance there is. And the Vietnam era was incredibly polarized. And so you got an awful lot of incivility in the Vietnam era. After that, as things quieted down, when they got rid of the draft, when that war finally ended, I think we went through a period where America was maybe polarized, but not as tense. Mm-hmm. Now, with the unending wars that are being fought by our all volunteer army, but at terrible, terrible cost to those men, mm-hmm. and women. I yes. mean, my heart goes out to these people. I've got family members who've been in Afghanistan and Iraq and redeployed. It's terrible hardship these people are facing. And then the economy, I know that's going to ratchet up anxiety and hatred, and that's what I think we're seeing. And chickens are coming home to roost in a terrible way for decisions I've never met a war I liked, mm-hmm. you know, as the bumper sticker goes, I'm already against the next war, mm-hmm. but we had no business attacking Iraq, and we had no business attacking Afghanistan, and we need to get out and leave a note saying, I'm sorry, you know?
What about the economy, though? Isn't our economy really tied up in all this military movement and implementation that, what, you know, the economy is already in bad shape? And if they end the war, doesn't that make it even worse?
You know, there are things that are difficult to see the consequences. And there are things that are the right thing to do. And everything might have a negative consequence. But we squander our wealth on military adventurism. I can't think that if we free up that money for use for healthcare and housing and Lord knows, let's end the war on drugs. It is the most absurd war we've fought for the longest time.
Let's unsuccessfully
just legalize and tax them, and then we won't have a deficit anymore. I'm not afraid of the consequences of ending war, and I'd bring all our troops home from all over the world. I don't think we need to be afraid of anybody, that we need to keep them surrounded.
We have plenty of people right here at home, right?
we've got plenty of work to do, and munitions aren't helping anybody.
Well, thank you very much, Guy. I'm sure you've stirred some people to think tonight, and that's always a good thing. I really appreciate your joining me on Interchange. I appreciate it very much. And we'll look forward to retirement, won't we? Or maybe we'll never retire.
No,
that's probably
I don't intend to. But I want to say, because I don't remember ever having the chance to say, thank you for taking care of Fawn Licker, my little dog, back when you lived in Needmore.
Well, you're most welcome. She did live a really long time until a hunter shot her. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
And that is Interchange for tonight. I'm Helen Harrell. Thanks to our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by William Morris, and the executive producer is Chad Carruthers. The original theme music is produced by Jamil Effiam. And now stay tuned for the House of Jazz with Tillman, coming up next on WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.